Good morning. There's been a lot of news around health updates, economic analysis, and all kinds of COVID-19 everything. And by golly, we'll get there. But not just yet. Let's start with something beautiful. The music of Colin McNamara and the birds from Ray Darcy's garden. Now, let's get into it. This week, the number of people dying from COVID-19 increased significantly, and clusters of the virus are appearing among healthcare workers and nursing homes in particular. Yesterday, Seán O'Rourke spoke to Sam McConkie from the Department of Tropical Medicine and International Medicine at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
Just as a specialist in infectious diseases, how concerned should we be that we now have apparently 9 clusters in nursing homes and 8 clusters in hospitals, as well as 2 clusters in long-stay residential care facilities?
Well, it's certainly worrying because it's hard to move people from, if they're in that nursing home, it's hard to move them to another one because there's a worry then they would transmit it to another one. So, and the folks, especially in nursing homes and even in hospitals, are elderly and vulnerable. It's not surprising. We know that this is an illness, you know, that's reasonably infectious, and it can have 4 or 5 days of incubation before it becomes obvious. So, unfortunately, I'm not particularly surprised about that. But we have to try and deal with it robustly.
And that is contact tracing and self-isolation, all things we pretty much know, in theory anyway. But how are we faring with it all? Well, on Monday, Seán spoke to Dr. David Nabarro, WHO's coronavirus response envoy, who was leaving us in no doubt as to what was needed.
I plead with governments everywhere, do not delay, act now. The virus is being transmitted everywhere. The cases we see are evidence of transmission 10 days ago. You do not know what's going to be coming. But the Italian lessons, the Iranian lessons, the Chinese lessons are there for us. And that means please do whatever you can, even if it means discomfort for people now, because the level of pain will be much, much greater the longer we delay.
David,
remember, it doubles every 2.5 days.
In saying that, David Nabarro, is it your view, for instance, that the kind of restrictions that have been imposed by the governments in France and also in Spain and latterly Germany, banning gatherings of more than 2 people, that they should be implemented right across the board?
To me, it is incomprehensible that in Europe we have different countries with different policies when we know that the outbreaks are going to hit every country. It's just a matter of time. So why not, if you are at an early stage, act robustly? Because that action will greatly reduce the size of the problem you have to deal with. In 1 week, this thing grows 8 times. In 2 weeks, it grows 40 times. In 3 weeks, it grows nearly 300 times. In 4 weeks, it's 1,000 times. Every day of delay creates a much, much bigger problem in the long run, as our Italian colleagues are seeing. Why don't we learn the lesson?
Well, on Tuesday, the government introduced more measures aimed at further restricting the spread of the virus.
All theatres, clubs, gyms, leisure centres, hairdressers, betting offices, marts, markets, casinos, bingo halls, libraries and other similar outlets are to shut. All hotels to limit occupancy to essential non-social and non-tourist reasons. All non-essential retail outlets are to close to members of the public and all other retail outlets are to implement physical distancing. All cafes and restaurants should limit supply to takeaways and deliveries only. All sporting events are cancelled, including those held behind closed doors. All playgrounds and holiday caravan parks will close. All places of worship are to restrict numbers entering at any one time. All organised social indoor and outdoor events of any size are not to take place.
Ooh, that's a pretty comprehensive shutting of doors. And while you might call it a lockdown, our Taoiseach does not.
I wouldn't use the term lockdown, and that's for very good reasons. I've come to learn over the past week or two the lockdown seems to mean very different things to different people and in different countries, and therefore can cause confusion, and we need clarity rather than confusion. So I saw, for example, even though he didn't use the term, the changes announced in the UK as being a lockdown of the UK, yet when you look at the detail of what's being announced in the UK, people can still go to work, still go to the shops, the bank, the post office, even B&Q, the pet food store, go for a run and meet with another person outside. You know, so that, in my mind, isn't a total lockdown.
Not a lockdown, but fierce quiet. And of course, all of that before Prime Minister Boris Johnson tested positive for COVID-19. But now there is another element with which we might have to contend, the asymptomatic spreader, gulp. This is Luke O'Neill, Professor at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College Dublin, with Mary Wilson on Monday.
Well, these are people with no symptoms at all of the COVID-19, and yet they could be, would you describe them as vectors for the disease? They can be spreading the virus all of the time. This is really dangerous, as many as 60% of the infections.
That's right. There was a big study done, Mary, and the good thing is the science is getting better and better all the time, remember, because they're examining all these patients in great detail and so on. They examined 26,000 cases in China, and they realised that at least 60%, they caught it off someone who didn't have symptoms. It's a very high percentage, much higher than, this was sort of an idea that was kicking around for a while anyway, you know, for the last few weeks. But that's quite a high percentage now. So that means you may get infected from someone who's no symptoms at all. Right. And that means we have to socially distance then for definite, obviously. That's another justification, if you like, for this social distancing. And what I think is happening is if you have very, very mild disease, you're not coughing that much, say, and you don't have too many symptoms and you hardly think you have any symptoms at all, it's probably still in your throat. It hasn't quite got down to your lungs yet, you know. So therefore, those lung symptoms aren't there. In your throat, the virus can still be shed. It can still come out of the cells and end up then spreading on a bit of spit to someone else, you know. In fact, the advice is, Mary, everybody should assume that you're infected. That's the best advice at the moment.
Wow.
Wow is right. So, assume you're a spreader and stay home. Never has boredom been so patriotic. Unless you think you get tested and are happily negative, well, even that might not be a license to go forth and party. Here's Dr. Liam Glynn, Professor of General Practice at the University of Limerick, talking to Sean O'Rourke.
Because even if you get tested and you get a negative result from that test, it is still possible in about 1 in 5 cases, and this is anecdotal evidence from around the world, that you may still be positive. So even getting a negative test isn't 100% reassuring. So people need to understand that as well, and not use that as a carte blanche to do whatever they want.
So are you saying that, Liam, that there could be up to 20% false negatives being returned from these tests?
It's a swab test, so technically it can be difficult to do. It can be, when it's tested in different labs, that can also increase the likelihood of getting a false negative. This isn't an exact science. And the reason I'm saying that is not to scare people, but it's to say to people that everybody, no matter who you are, and what situation you're in, you need to think as if you have COVID-19. How would I act if I had COVID-19? Or if you're going to potentially meet somebody outside your small family unit, how would I act if they had COVID-19? And if you then act accordingly to that principle, then we will definitely halt the transmission of this disease in our communities.
And the ability of this virus to spread like soft butter on hot toast, well, even the level-headed, unflappable Mary Wilson was looking askance at her surroundings. Back to Dr. Luke O'Neill.
And I know we're learning all the time, but what can you tell us about how long the virus survives on surfaces? And I'm talking about door handles, toilets, your kitchen counter, all of the surfaces that we all touch. I'm sitting in a studio now, you know, with a mouse for my computer and various other areas that I'm going to touch over the course of the next hour and a half or so. How long can the virus survive on these surfaces?
Yeah, again, there was a great study, Mary, last week in New England Journal of Medicine, which is the world's number one Atlantic have done a really systematic analysis of that now, and the answer, sadly, is days. And the virus can last for days on glass, on metal especially. It seems that the spit that comes out of the mouth, it seems to form a little gel on those surfaces, and the virus can live inside that gel. So it especially likes those surfaces. Other surfaces, it's not as many days, but still, it's of the order of days, you know. So again, the essential thing is to keep those surfaces clean. And again, it's very simple. As you know, Mary, it's literally, you know, a 1 in 5 dilution of bleach kills this virus dead. Or soapy water. It's very simple to kill it, you know, especially on door handles and the backs of chairs and, you know, places people touch. Keep those surfaces clean is the advice, of course.
That was Monday's drive time. On Wednesday, however, the criteria for testing for the virus changed. Here's Fergal Bowers on Morning Ireland.
They will have to have 2 major symptoms, a fever and a cough or shortness of breath. The priority groups are close contacts of a confirmed case, healthcare staff who are vital to the delivery of the service, and also vulnerable groups who have symptoms.
So test, but targeted testing. Well, on Thursday, Sean spoke to the West's finest, Mike Ryan, Executive Director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Programme, and he asked him about this new criteria and its rationale.
But if the priority is trying to find the cases and stop the spread, is more widespread testing not essential?
I think case definitions shift and change over time, particularly at the beginning of an epidemic or pandemic where we don't understand the pathogen. The health authorities in Ireland have moved the case definition to actually be in line with WHO's case definition. And it has a purpose. And the purpose is to ensure that we're focused on detecting and testing the suspect cases, the people most likely to have this disease. Testing is a finite resource, and testing as many people as possible is good. But you also, at the same time, need to test those most likely to have the disease, because they're the people you need rapid testing for, rapid results for, because they're the people that need to be isolated. The factors are around where do you put your resources? Where's the best place to spend your euro? Where's the best place to use a finite resource? It's exactly the same when it comes to protective equipment from health workers. You have to look at prioritizing and rational use of PPE for health workers. So it's not just about having more and doing more. It's about using what you have in a more efficient and more directed way so that you can preserve those precious resources for those who most need them.
So finite resources properly targeted, fair enough. But the human cost of this pandemic right across the world is something that just can't be underestimated. On Wednesday, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Mayo native Jacinta McCarthy, who's based in Bergamo in Italy.
We're living, as you outlined there, under the harshest restrictions, but we have to do it, Sean. It's the only way we can slow this down. It's a silent, eerie vigil. There's no one smiling behind the mask, Sean, in the supermarket or elsewhere. So we're limiting any trips out. We don't want to be outside, Sean. Here it's safe inside our own four walls. We don't know what's out there, who you'll brush up against, what's contaminated. We have a lovely back garden. I'm an avid gardener, and it's probably one of the few things keeping me safe sane right now, if you know what I mean. But a lot of Italians don't. You know, they're in high-rise apartments cooped up with little or no balcony or outdoor space. I was actually just recounting a tale there last Thursday. My children were outside enjoying the fresh air in the back, and I just went round to the front gate to collect the post, and there was a little old man stooped over to standing there with his shopping bag, and I just asked him, was he okay? And he said to me, Signora, are they your children I hear in the garden? And I nodded at him, and he said, Signora, I just want to stay here and listen to them laugh and play. He said, I haven't heard a child in weeks. They're all locked away. So sad. But
it's
we have
so
to
poignant.
Stop this sadness. And I hope he passes my gate again. I pray for them, him and all people like him. But we have to do this, Sean. We have to respect the restrictions.
Jacinta McCarthy from Bergamo in Italy. And on Thursday evening, all around the country and in the Dáil, people paused at the Bell of Eight to pay tribute to our healthcare workers.
It was absolutely fantastic. We rounded the corner and here these clapping people, and you just feel everything you've been doing all this stressful day has been so worth it.
from Friday's Morning Ireland, and so say all of us a whopping shout out to all the frontline people in all of the sectors putting their health on the line to keep the country going. And in a small but vital ray of hope, the contact tracing number of people has gone from 20 per case down to 10 and now closer to 5. So what we're doing is working, so stay put, scrub up and sit in for Ireland. Those four walls won't stare at themselves. Back in a bit. Welcome back. While everyone's focus is quite rightly on lives and health, the economic impact of this crisis is nothing short of massive, and people are feeling the pressure. Job losses, reduced incomes, with businesses closing or suspended. On Tuesday, the government announced measures to the tune of $3.7 billion over 12 weeks to help the economy. Mary Wilson spoke to Professor Stephen Kinsella on Wednesday's Drive Time.
$3.7 billion. I'm not going to talk about whether it's sustainable or not. I'm just going to ask you, are we spending it well?
Yes, we're spending it very well. I think the most important thing that people listening to this need to hear is that their incomes and their living standards are going to be protected by the government for at least 12 weeks. It's going to be ferociously expensive, but it's absolutely worth every penny when you think that once the health, the public health part of the crisis is over, it will take many months for businesses and households to recover. So I think the government has done exactly the right thing. I really would like to commend Minister Donoghue and everyone really involved in it, because if you compare what Ireland has done to the UK's version, the supports that the Irish government has made available are actually being made available from Friday of this week, whereas in the UK they're going to wait another 5 or 6 weeks to roll out. So it's really fast, it's really vast, and I think it's just a genuinely really good thing that the government is, if you like, privileging society over the economy in this particular time.
Stephen, that's praise indeed from somebody who has at times been a harsh critic of how we've managed our economy over the last, since I suppose 2007 or 8 or thereabouts, as we went into the recession.
Indeed.
Indeed is right. However, money borrowed must be paid back. And Mary Wilson sounded a note of caution.
I think you've said, Stephen, this isn't magic money. It's money that will have to be paid back through taxes or made or borrowed. And, you know, we will have to pay back these loans and borrowings at some stage. So the burden that it will place on our economy will go on now for several years. We already had a huge debt.
Yeah. We already have a debt of over 200 billion euros. We are happily able to borrow at very low interest rates at the moment, so that's a very good thing. And there shouldn't be a particular uptick in the interest costs of the money that we're borrowing at the moment. So that's a very good thing. But people shouldn't imagine that the supports that are going into the economy over the next while can be continued. They are, as I said, ferociously expensive. It is absolutely right and correct that the government stimulates the economy at this particular time and supports the economy. But the fundamental principles of this are that it's fast, it's vast, and then it has to stop. And so when it stops, the question is, will people be left in a situation where they were getting money to help their employees up until, say, the 1st of September, and then on the 7th of September, they don't have those supports, you know? And so it's in that transition that there's a lot of risk, because, of course, any new government or any government empowered to do deficit spending will, of course, want to continue that. And there's a key risk in destabilising the state's finances in doing so, which is a worry.
Stephen,
that
lots
I would have.
Still to talk about.
Professor Stephen Kinsella with Mary. However, European leaders failed to agree on a coherent and common rescue package. Former Central Bank Governor Patrick Honohan spoke to Rachel English on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
As you say, Ireland is among a number of EU countries calling for the issuing of what's known as, or as what have been called, corona bonds. There is, though, division. What would such a bond do?
What the bond would do, it instead of each government putting its own creditworthiness on the line to issue whatever amounts of bonds it needs to meet the needs that we talked about, it would be a bond that would be issued with the collective signature of all of the European governments, and therefore markets would not be distinguishing between saying this country is more creditworthy than that country. It would be much easier to find buyers for such bonds, and that money would be distributed then to the countries to meet the needs. That's the idea. Why is it not happening? It's not happening for the same reasons that it hasn't happened for the past 10, 15 years. Doubts and suspicions by the more prudent and high-saving countries that their savings will be raided by the, if you like, it's the ants and the grasshoppers. The ants don't want the grasshoppers to come and take all their savings.
Ants and grasshoppers, the kind of ladybird economics even I can understand. Thank you, Patrick Honohan. Well, on Thursday, the Economic and Social Research Institute issued a report about the effect of COVID-19 on the Irish economy, which, brace yourself, Bridget, predicts the economy to shrink by more than 7% and unemployment to spike at 18%. Here's one of the report's authors, Professor Kieran McQuinn, with Anya Lawler on the News at One.
What most people want to know is, how bad will it be? How long will it be? And will it ever be the same again?
Well, as to how long it'll be, I'm afraid that obviously depends more on medical developments, really. You know, we have no real idea as to whether the virus can be contained in the next couple of, the next quarter, shall we say, in terms of the time period. In terms of how bad it can get, well, then clearly, I mean, we are in many respects, you know, heavily dependent clearly on how our own authorities are dealing with the situation. But ultimately, in terms of our recovery, we will also be dependent on how authorities elsewhere are dealing with the situation, you know, because we relied very heavily on trade, for example. And indeed, after the financial crisis, that was one of the mechanisms by which the economy recovered, was through trade. And so clearly, if all of our partners are experiencing grave and significant downturns, that will have very negative implications for us. I suppose the one silver lining, really, is that unlike many other European economies, the Irish economy has been performing very well over the last number of years. You know, we're coming into this crisis averaging around 5% growth over the last 6-7 years, whereas most European economies are really only experiencing around 1-1.5%. So the economy was in a good position. And when economic events stabilize, I think the economy will be well placed to pick up and recover. But the speed of that recovery at this point in time is almost impossible to call, really.
Professor Kieran McQuinn of the ESRI, and he did use the phrase silver lining. It's not a lot, but we're in straitened times, so we're going to take the win. Now, there have been many wonderful examples of people coming together to help and support one another. However, in some quarters, this pandemic is bringing out the worst in people, perhaps through sheer ignorance, perhaps it's something more malign. On Thursday, Oliver Callan spoke to Linda. She'd been out for a walk and chatting on the phone when she stepped out onto the road to avoid two young boys in her path. But then things took a turn.
I don't know whether they took umbrage at me stepping out or what. I've no idea. I mean, they were really quite young. One was barely older than my own children, about 10. The other was 13 or 14, those types of ages. Yeah. And the older one just turned and coughed at me, coughed or spat or sneezed. I don't know which, but he did that thing.
Yeah.
And I stopped and spoke to them and they stopped.
You challenged them, even though it's quite a shocking thing to happen.
It was a shocking thing to happen, but I'd heard about it earlier on the radio as well, and I wanted to call them out on it. And I said, lads, you can't be doing that. You might think it's funny. It's not funny. It's really frightening, and it's really dangerous at the moment.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, though, the younger one then started running at me and coughing and spitting.
My God.
So, my aunt could hear me kind of, I was shouting at that point, get off me, because I thought he was going to, you know, start handling me.
Physically attacking.
You know, I suppose my own children are a little younger than him. I have twins, and I suppose I was so shocked. In some ways, I felt very unthreatened because they were young, but I felt more threatened than I possibly ever have in my life.
Linda with Oliver on Thursday, but with the best will in the world, tempers are beginning to fray. Sophie phoned into Joe.
Wash your hands.
Duffy. She had gone to Aldi with her 2.5-year-old son. She's a single parent whose own parents are in self-isolation.
I was walking in the door and I was on the right-hand side. There's the table to sanitise your hands and get gloves and all that. So I was just getting ready to do that when all of a sudden this person in front of me just turned around and started shouting at me and telling me to get back, that I'm not 2 metres apart from him. And it took a second to register what was happening.
Yeah.
And I had my son like standing next to me. So I took a step back and then he shouted, get back further, just very aggressively in my face, told me that I had no respect bringing my child into the supermarket. I was completely lost for words, like embarrassed, humiliated, and I didn't know what to say. Other customers were coming up saying, don't mind him, like he has no right. And at that stage, I left because nothing was that important. I just wanted to leave. But I just think that it's unfair for people to assume that you're not doing your bit, you know, and people policing each other. Like, it's not going to, things are going to break down very quickly if that keeps happening.
Yeah.
You know, like, if everyone does their bit and, in a sense, mind their business to a degree until we're given stricter guidelines.
And was there, like, were you even accidentally close to him?
Potentially, yes. But then as soon as he said that, like, I did take a step back. But, I mean, I think that it's fair to have a little bit of empathy for people, too, that this is a new concept.
Ooh, Sophie on Liveline. Well, we know we're all collectively feeling a bit pent up and hemmed in when no less a regal presence than Olivia O'Leary is getting cranky and snappy.
These days, I find I'm two people. There's adult me and bratty me. Adult me does all the washing, disinfecting and responsible social distancing. But bratty me breaks through, like in the supermarket the other day when the assistant told me that the 10 euros off voucher that I presented was out of date. I crumpled it up crossly, and then I caught myself on. I'm sorry, I said to the assistant. We're so lucky we have food shops open at all, and lucky that people like you are brave enough to come in and serve us. She went on doing her job, brave woman, and I crept out, blushing, to the car. It's like a sort of grief, this time of fighting the virus. We realise it anew every day, waking in the morning, and once again remembering what we face. Spring is bursting out regardless. The birdsong and the bleating lambs are as gloriously raucous as an orchestra tuning up, and I saw my first primroses the other day. But you know, part of me wanted to say, go back. This is no time to be flaunting yourselves as though you have anything to celebrate. However, nature is inexorable, and thank goodness it is. The Donegal poet Moya Cannon puts it this way in her poem, Flowers Know Nothing of Our Grief. But the roses, pink and delicate, unfurl their buds in the sunshine, scent the steps up to the front door. Their indifference should break us. Instead, they shore up a dike against despair. They play a tune in a minor key. They whisper among themselves in an old Esperanto. They intimate that hope is never dead until this bewildered earth stops throwing up roses.
The poetry of Moya Cannon, read by Olivia O'Leary. Back in a bit. Welcome back. You know, it's not often you'd be wishing for a bit of rain, but frankly, the fine weather may be the ruination of us. After last weekend's outdoor shenanigans, the watchword is no longer social distancing, but physically distancing. 2 metres, 6 feet. Ray Darcy was not impressed.
There were breaches on the beaches yesterday. Breaches on the beaches. I see Bannerstrand down in Kerry was shut down. Now, I can't understand that because I've been on Bannerstrand, and if you go from Barrow up to Ballyhaig, it's 10 kilometres long. And when the tide's out, it could be 50 to 100 metres in depth. So do the maths on that. Now, how many people with a circle of 6 feet or 2 metres, how many people can you fit on that? So I don't know what's going on with people. 6 feet apart or else somebody's going to be 6 feet under. You see, the problem is that the people who are gathering in groups are not listening to Morning Ireland. They're not listening to me. They're obviously not listening to Leo Varadkar or Simon Harris or Tony Holohan or anybody. Because they're invincible. They're invincible. And this is sort of selfish, but they're spoiling it for the rest of us. I like my run in the morning. I'm making sure that I'm 6 feet away from people. We wave and we smile. And if we have to give way, we give way. And we're exercising physical, social, safe distancing, whatever you want to call it. But because of the people who aren't, it looks like stricter regulations are going to be introduced. And to be honest, I'll be pissed off. I will be pissed off. But if it has to be done for the common good, I will do it.
Oh, Scorcio. And Ryan Turberty was also a presenter annoyed at those flaunting the regulations.
There are fools around the place, and I'm not afraid to say that they're fools. And I wish that there's no point in saying it too loudly, because most fools don't know they're being fools, and they don't know they're fools, which is why they continue to be fools.
Fools indeed, and it was joggers and runners in particular that drew the ire of Ryan. He's having none of the flying sweat and random hocking up of fluids.
I admire that you're jogging, and I appreciate that you want to get out and jog, but a number of us have spotted you not only sneezing without covering, but also that phlegm that you hock up and spit. Carry a tissue. Respect us. Respect each other. And don't be coughing on the ground and spitting on the ground. That's not acceptable. That day is behind us for now. So jog away, run away, absolutely all of those things. But respect your fellow citizens by, at the very least, carrying a tissue either in your hand, or if there's a pocket in your shorts, I don't care where it is. But do not, please, spit and cough about the place when you're out jogging in public.
A dig at runner Darcy? Surely not. Well, Ray, he's a runner, but not that kind of runner.
I am a jogger, runner, but I keep my social distance. And if somebody's coming towards me, I stop, step aside, let them pass. If I run, make sure there's 6 feet, and everybody should do that. We're all in this together.
Ooh, relief all round. Of course, there's no unnecessary sprinting or indeed horseplay in the corridors of Montrose at the moment anyway. On Monday, Ryan spoke to two people who had obsessive compulsive disorder. First up is Rebecca Ryan, for whom the current atmosphere, well...
With all this hand washing and hand sanitising that's going on all the time, and completely and necessarily so, what do you think you, Rebecca, with OCD, would have made of this?
I think I would have found it slightly ironic, to be quite honest, because I've seen a lot of people hand washing and sanitizing and wearing gloves and things, and I'm thinking, I've seen this before in OCD documentaries, but now the whole world is doing it. It's really weird to me. Like, the whole world is experiencing anxiety that someone with OCD would experience on a daily basis.
And Ryan also spoke to Claire Doyle, who had studied the psychology of OCD.
What is happening for people with OCD at this time?
I suppose it's confirming what you have feared, in a way. I walked into my supermarket on Friday morning, and all the people I know were wearing gloves. Yeah. Some were wearing masks.
Yes.
And it's like a confirmation of what you feared all the time.
But before the virus?
Yes.
The fear would have been kind of irrational, wouldn't it? And I'm not saying that to be mean, but...
Yeah, no.
You know,
you're right.
There was no... We didn't need... We need germs sometimes at that time, not now, obviously, as you know.
Yeah.
So there was a sort of... You know what I'm talking about. You've done the psychology of all of this. So the confirmation is a sort of false confirmation in some ways, because it's a pandemic. It's an absolutely unlikely, unwelcome scenario.
And that's exactly what you have to remember when you have OCD now. That this is a pandemic, it's a point in time that will resolve itself, and to remember that, and not to let the OCD go on overdrive.
Yes.
Or not to think that, oh, I was right all the time, because you weren't right, it's just the way you're perceiving your environment.
That makes perfect sense.
Okay.
And how are you coping with it all?
I'm actually coping fine. I mean, I can put it into perspective. I studied the brain and what parts of the brain are affected in OCD. The limbic system is a major part, and there's a little structure called the amygdala that creates that gut-wrenching fear. So when I feel the fear, I'm thinking, that's my amygdala in overdrive there, and I just settle my thoughts and then just move forward with whatever I'm doing. And I suppose I'd be more aware of people in the public. There's some people I look at and they're petrified. You can see it in them just doing their shopping. You feel sorry for them and want to say, don't be so afraid, we'll be okay.
The Tuberty Show on Monday, and of course all of that was before this happened on Wednesday.
And a very good morning to you, and welcome to the Tuberty Show without the Tuberty. It's Oliver Callan here to fill your ears for the next hour. Ryan has had a persistent cough over the last few days, and he's getting it checked out, so no need to worry, he's getting it checked out, and hopefully he will be back.
Oh, fallen comrade, get well soon, Ryan, whatever ails you. And there'll be Eve's pudding nut-free on the menu when you do get back. And we know that Ryan is a fan of the reading, so perhaps something gothic might be fitting for these strange days. Here's Daryl Jones with Sean Rocks on Arena.
It's a cultural and it's an aesthetic mode. It's not a genre exactly. It's not a form exactly. It's a mode or a mood or perhaps even a sensibility that's associated with and that expresses darkness and death. It is irrationality, obsession, madness, the passions, sensuality, disorder, obsessions with the past and its mysteries, darkness and decay. These are the characteristics of the Gothic. There is something always excessive about it. It was famously, Gothic literature was once famously described as the literature of excess. It's transgressive. It bursts out of boundaries. It's over the top. It's too much. Mm. It's not respectable. It antagonizes. It's an overpouring of emotion. It's the unconscious mind coming to the fore. It's extreme psychological states. These are the characteristics of the Gothic.
Mm. So over the top, excessive. Are we talking about being out of control? Are we beyond the rules of normal human behaviour?
Well, we're beyond the rules of realistic representational art. That's for sure. But there are whole areas of human experience for which realism really has nothing to say. Extreme spiritual experiences, for example, or the farther shores of psychological states, as in madness, the unconscious mind. These are whole areas of human experience that are real, but which realism has very little to say about. It can sometimes seem like a chaotic form, but it's there to express something that is within us.
Ooh, Gothic really does seem to fit the bill. That was Daryl Jones on Arena. Writer and artist Sarah Baum was John Kelly's guest on Sunday night. Her new book, Handiwork, is a non-fiction book focusing on craft, which seems curiously apt.
Well, what's amateur craft? What is that?
Well, amateur craft is like railway modelling is something I talk about. Mm-hmm. Paint by numbers, you know, like if you go into the art and hobby shop and you see, it would be more so, I guess, art that's based on kits. But I mean, crocheting, cross-stitch.
Airfix models,
yeah. But it came about as a kind of a rebellion against capitalism. When I started reading about amateur craft, I became very interested in its origins. I mean, not that consciously, but placed in that context, as in, you know, free time. What do we do with our time? And when, sort of since the Industrial Revolution or whatever, time has been very organized. You know, you work for however many hours, and then what you do with the rest of your time, doing something completely useless with it, can kind of be seen as a form of rebellion. What's important, what's very important to me, is the handmade. And the more that I wrote, I suppose, the more I would also want to balance it with the work of the hands. Like I say, I find writing arduous and difficult, but I find working with my hands is catharsis after that, you know. In order to sort of recover in a way from having two novels out in quite quick succession over the course of 2 years, I decided that I just wanted to work with my hands for a year or two and see how that went. I guess after I quickly sort of became frustrated, I guess I felt awful about the amount of time I was spending on these useless projects, seemingly useless projects. And I started taking notes about why I felt this insistence to do it. And what fell into the same time period was, I think, my dad dying and feeling slightly bewildered and not wanting to write, perhaps because of that, because of grief, but also re-establishing a connection to him that I didn't fully realise, appreciate the meaning of when he was alive.
Sarah Baum with John Kelly on the pleasure of craft and creation. But if reading, crochet or indeed macrame isn't your thing, you might be driven to finally fixing that bockety wardrobe or putting up the shelf or hacking at those errant tree branches. Time to dust off that power drill, you say? Well, maybe not. Here's orthopaedic surgeon Aaron Glynn with Oliver Callan.
I would ask people, if they can at all, just please hold off on the long-term projects. Don't be hanging out of ladder, for God's sake. Lawnmowers, weeding, you know, all that stuff needs to be done, absolutely. But just maybe hold off on the stuff involving ladders that haven't been done for the last few years. It can probably wait a few more months.
And in normal times, do you see a kind of a spike in ladder-related or DIY injuries in your
absolutely this time of year? Yeah, especially especially the first sunny weekend of the year is always it's carnage. We're just asking people to hold off on that kind of work for just a few more weeks or months.
But people are generally sensible. Yes,
are generally sensible, but by God, do they get full of enthusiasm when they see a sunny day out there and they've been cooped up and they're bored and they're looking for something to do and they want to get out there. And, you know, I think there's so much we can do outdoors at the moment, but just maybe just put those projects on the long finger because this might not be the best time.
Step away from the power tools. Not the time to try the circular saw. On Sunday, actor Barry McGovern joined Miriam O'Callaghan with some poetry.
Here's a poem called Pandemic by Lynn Ungar.
I hope this is an uplifting poem about
pandemic. It is uplifting, yes. She's a Christian minister from San Francisco, and it was written very, very recently because of this present crisis. But it is uplifting. What if you thought of it as the Jews consider the Sabbath the most sacred of times? Cease from travel. Cease from buying and selling. Give up just for now on trying to make the world different than it is. Sing. Pray. Touch only those to whom you commit your life. Center down. And when your body has become still, reach out with your heart. Know that we are connected in ways that are terrifying and beautiful. You could hardly deny it now. Know that our lives are in one another's hands. Surely that has come clear. Do not reach out your hands. Reach out your heart. Reach out your words. Reach out all the tendrils of compassion that move invisibly where we cannot touch. Promise this world your love, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, so long as we all shall live.
Barry McGovern reading Pandemic by poet Lynn Ungar. Well, that's almost it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. And in case you're wondering what the week ahead holds.
Virgo, you'll be spending time in your home. Scorpio, you'll be spending time in your home. Sagittarius, you'll be spending time in your home. And so on.
Oh, well, so be it, I suppose. Exceptions obviously made for us Pisceans. But we'll get an extra hour of sunshine in the evening with the clocks going forward. So up you get and have a dance.
I was dancing when I was 12. I was dancing when I was 12. I was dancing when I was out. I was dancing when I was out. I danced myself right out the womb. I danced myself right out the womb. Is it strange to dance so soon? I danced myself right out. Dancing when I was 8. I was dancing when I was 8. Is it strange to dance so late? Is it strange to dance so late? Myself into the tomb. Is it strange to dance so soon? I dance myself into the tomb. Is it wrong to understand the fear that dwells inside a man? What's it like to be alone? I like a need to have a love.
myself out of the womb. Is it strange to dance so soon? I dance myself into the tomb. Myself out.